Chapter 7. Clock case which follows this paper. He brought it to me not long ago at midnight, and informed me that the main incident had been suggested by a dream of the night before. His apartments are two cheerful rooms looking towards the garden, and one of his great delights is to arrange and rearrange the furniture in these chambers, and put it in every possible variety of position. During the whole time he has been here, I do not think he has slept for two nights running with the head of his bed in the same place, and every time he moves it, is to be the last. My housekeeper was at first well nigh distracted by these frequent changes, but she has become quite reconciled to them by degrees, and has so fallen in with his humor that they often consult together with great gravity upon the next final alteration. Whatever his arrangements are, however, they are always a pattern of neatness, and every one of the manifold articles connected with his manifold occupations is to be found in its own particular place. Until within the last 2 or 3 years he was subject to an occasional fit which usually came upon him in very fine weather, under the influence of which he would dress himself with peculiar care, and, going out under pretense of taking a walk, disappeared for several days together. At length, after the interval between each outbreak of this disorder had gradually grown longer and longer, it wholly disappeared. And now he seldom stirs abroad, except to stroll out a little way on a summer's evening. Whether he yet mistrusts his own constancy in this respect, and is therefore afraid to wear a coat, I know not, but we seldom see him in any other upper garment than an old spectral-looking dressing gown, with very disproportionate pockets, full of a miscellaneous collection of odd matters, which he picks up wherever he can lay his hands upon them. Everything that is a favorite with our friend, is a favorite with us, and thus it happens that the fourth among us is Mr. Owen Miles, a most worthy gentleman, who had treated Jack with great kindness before my deaf friend and I encountered him by an accident, to which I may refer on some future occasion. Mr. Miles was once a very rich merchant, but receiving a severe shock in the death of his wife, he retired from business, and devoted himself to a quiet, unostentatious life. He is an excellent man, of thoroughly sterling character. Not of quick apprehension, and not without some amusing prejudices, which I shall leave to their own development. He holds us all in profound veneration, but Jack Redburn he esteems as a kind of pleasant wonder that he may venture to approach familiarly. He believes, not only that no man ever lived who could do so many things as Jack, but that no man ever lived who could do anything so well, and he never calls my attention to any of his ingenious proceedings, but he whispers in my ear, nudging me at the same time with his elbow, "If he had only made it his trade, sir, if he had only made it his trade." ... They are inseparable companions. One would almost suppose that, although Mr. Miles never by any chance does anything in the way of assistance, Jack could do nothing without him. Whether he is reading, writing, painting, carpentering, gardening, flute playing, or what not, there is Mr. Miles beside him, buttoned up to the chin in his blue coat, and looking on with a face of incredulous delight, as though he could not credit the testimony of his own senses, and had a misgiving that no man could be so clever but in a dream. These are my friends. I have now introduced myself and them. The clock case, a confession found in a prison in the time of Charles II. I held a lieutenant's commission in His Majesty's Army, and served abroad in the campaigns of 1677 and 1678. The Treaty of Nimeguen being concluded, I returned home, and retiring from the service, withdrew to a small estate lying a few miles east of London, which I had recently acquired in right of my wife. This is the last night I have to live, and I will set down the naked truth without disguise. I was never a brave man, and had always been from my childhood of a secret, sullen, distrustful nature. I speak of myself as if I had passed from the world, for while I write this, my grave is digging, and my name is written in the black book of death. Soon after my return to England, my only brother was seized with mortal illness. This circumstance gave me slight or no pain, for since we had been men, we had associated, but very little together. He was open-hearted and generous, handsomer than I, more accomplished, and generally beloved. Those who sought my acquaintance abroad or at home, because they were friends of his, seldom attached themselves to me long, and would usually say, in our first conversation, that they were surprised to find two brothers, so unlike in their manners and appearance. It was my habit to lead them on to this avowal, for I knew what comparisons they must draw between us. And having a rankling envy in my heart, I sought to justify it to myself. We had married two sisters. This additional tie between us, as it may appear to some, only estranged us the more. His wife knew me well. I never struggled with any secret jealousy or gall when she was present, but that woman knew it as well as I did. I never raised my eyes at such times, but I found hers fixed upon me. I never bent them on the ground or looked another way, but I felt that she overlooked me always. It was an inexpressible relief to me when we quarreled, and a greater relief still when I heard abroad that she was dead. It seems to me now as if some strange and terrible foreshadowing of what has happened since must have hung over us then. I was afraid of her. She haunted me. Her fixed and steady look comes back upon me now, like the memory of a dark dream, and makes my blood run cold. She died shortly after giving birth to a child, a boy. When my brother knew that all hope of his own recovery was past, he called my wife to his bedside, and confided this orphan, a child of 4 years old, to her protection. He bequeathed to him all the property he had, and willed that, in case of his child's death, it should pass to my wife, as the only acknowledgement he could make her for her care and love. He exchanged a few brotherly words with me, deploring our long separation, and being exhausted, fell into a slumber, from which he never awoke. We had no children. And as there had been a strong affection between the sisters, and my wife had almost supplied the place of a mother to this boy, she loved him, as if he had been her own. The child was ardently attached to her, but he was his mother's image in face and spirit, and always mistrusted me. I can scarcely fix the date when the feeling first came upon me, but I soon began to be uneasy when this child was by. I never roused myself from some moody train of thought, but I marked him looking at me, not with mere childish wonder, but with something of the purpose and meaning that I had so often noted in his mother. It was no effort of my fancy, founded on close resemblance of feature and expression. I never could look the boy down. He feared me, but seemed by some instinct to despise me while he did so. And even when he drew back beneath my gaze as he would when we were alone, to get nearer to the door he would keep his bright eyes upon me still. Perhaps I hide the truth from myself, but I do not think that, when this began, I meditated to do him any wrong. I may have thought how serviceable his inheritance would be to us, and may have wished him dead, but I believe I had no thought of compassing his death. Neither did the idea come upon me at once, but by very slow degrees, presenting itself at first in dim shapes at a very great distance, as men may think of an earthquake or the last day, then drawing nearer and nearer, and losing something of its horror and improbability, then coming to be part and parcel, nay, nearly the whole sum and substance of my daily thoughts, and resolving itself into a question of means and safety, not of doing or abstaining from the deed. While this was going on within me, I never could bear that the child should see me looking at him, and yet I was under a fascination which made it a kind of business with me to contemplate his slight and fragile figure, and think how easily it might be done. Sometimes I would steal upstairs, and watch him as he slept, but usually I hovered in the garden near the window of the room in which he learned his little tasks. And there, as he sat upon a low seat beside my wife, I would peer at him for hours together from behind a tree, starting, like the guilty wretch I was, at every rustling of a leaf, and still gliding back to look and start again. Hard by our cottage, but quite out of sight, and, if there were any wind astir, of hearing too, was a deep sheet of water. I spent days in shaping with my pocket knife a rough model of a boat, which I finished at last and dropped in the child's way. Then I withdrew to a secret place, which he must pass, if he stole away alone to swim this bauble, and lurked there for his coming. He came neither that day nor the next, though I waited from noon till nightfall. I was sure that I had him in my net, for I had heard him prattling of the toy, and knew that in his infant pleasure he kept it by his side in bed. I felt no weariness or fatigue, but waited patiently, and on the third day he passed me, running joyously along, with his silken hair streaming in the wind, and he singing God have mercy upon me, singing a merry ballad, who could hardly list the words. I stole down after him, creeping under certain shrubs which grow in that place, and none but devils know with what terror I, a strong, full-grown man, tracked the footsteps of that baby as he approached the water's brink. I was close upon him, had sunk upon my knee, and raised my hand to thrust him in, when he saw my shadow in the stream, and turned him round. His mother's ghost was looking from his eyes. The sun burst forth from behind a cloud. It shone in the bright sky, the glistening earth, the clear water, the sparkling drops of rain upon the leaves. There were eyes in everything. The whole great universe of light was there to see the murder done. I know not what he said. He came of bold and manly blood, and, child as he was, he did not crouch or fawn upon me. I heard him cry that he would try to love me, not that he did, and then I saw him running back towards the house. The next I saw was my own sword naked in my hand, and he lying at my feet stark dead, dabbled here and there with blood, but otherwise no different from what I had seen him in his sleep in the same attitude too, with his cheek resting upon his little hand. I took him in my arms, and laid him very gently now that he was dead in a thicket. My wife was from home that day, and would not return until the next. Our bedroom window, the only sleeping room on that side of the house, was but a few feet from the ground, and I resolved to descend from it at night, and bury him in the garden. I had no thought that I had failed in my design, no thought that the water would be dragged and nothing found, that the money must now lie waste, since I must encourage the idea that the child was lost or stolen. All my thoughts were bound up, and knotted together in the one absorbing necessity of hiding what I had done. How I felt when they came to tell me that the child was missing, when I ordered scouts in all directions, when I gasped and trembled at everyone's approach, no tongue can tell, or mind of man conceive. I buried him that night. When I parted the boughs and looked into the dark thicket, there was a glowworm shining like the visible spirit of God upon the murdered child. I glanced down into his grave, when I had placed him there, and still it gleamed upon his breast, an eye of fire looking up to heaven in supplication to the stars that watched me at my work. I had to meet my wife, and break the news, and give her hope that the child would soon be found. All this I did, with some appearance, I suppose, of being sincere, for I was the object of no suspicion. This done, I sat at the bedroom window all day long, and watched the spot where the dreadful secret lay. It was in a piece of ground which had been dug up to be newly turfed, and which I had chosen on that account, as the traces of my spade were less likely to attract attention. The men who laid down the grass must have thought me mad. I called to them continually to expedite their work, ran out and worked beside them, trod down the earth with my feet, and hurried them with frantic eagerness. They had finished their task before night, and then I thought myself comparatively safe. I slept, not as men do who awake refreshed and cheerful, but I did sleep, passing from vague and shadowy dreams of being hunted down, to visions of the plot of grass, through which now a hand, and now a foot, and now the head itself was starting out. At this point I always woke and stole to the window, to make sure that it was not really so. That done, I crept to bed again, And thus I spent the night in fits and starts, getting up and lying down full 20 times, and dreaming the same dream over and over again, which was far worse than lying awake, for every dream had a whole night's suffering of its own. Once I thought the child was alive, and that I had never tried to kill him. To wake from that dream was the most dreadful agony of all. The next day I sat at the window again, never once taking my eyes from the place, which, although it was covered by the grass, was as plain to me its shape, its size, its depth, its jagged sides, and all as if it had been open to the light of day. When a servant walked across it, I felt as if he must sink in. When he had passed, I looked to see that his feet had not worn the edges. If a bird lighted there, I was in terror lest by some tremendous interposition it should be instrumental in the discovery. If a breath of air sighed across it, to me it whispered murder. There was not a sight or a sound how ordinary, mean, or unimportant soever, but was fraught with fear. And in this state of ceaseless watching I spent 3 days. On the fourth there came to the gate one who had served with me abroad, accompanied by a brother officer of his whom I had never seen. I felt that I could not bear to be out of sight of the place. It was a summer evening, and I bade my people take a table and a flask of wine into the garden. Then I sat down with my chair upon the grave, and being assured that nobody could disturb it now without my knowledge, tried to drink and talk. They hoped that my wife was well, that she was not obliged to keep her chamber, that they had not frightened her away. What could I do but tell them with a faltering tongue about the child? The officer whom I did not know was a down-looking man, and kept his eyes upon the ground while I was speaking. Even that terrified me. I could not divest myself of the idea that he saw something there which caused him to suspect the truth. I asked him hurriedly if he supposed that and stopped. That the child has been murdered? ?" said he, looking mildly at me. Oh no! What could a man gain by murdering a poor child? I could have told him what a man gained by such a deed, no one better. But I held my peace and shivered, as with an ague. Mistaking my emotion, they were endeavoring to cheer me with the hope that the boy would certainly be found great cheer that was for me. When we heard a low deep howl, and presently there sprung over the wall two great dogs, who, bounding into the garden, repeated the baying sound we had heard before. Bloodhounds! Cried my visitors. What need to tell me that? I had never seen one of that kind in all my life. But I knew what they were, and for what purpose they had come. I grasped the elbows of my chair, and neither spoke nor moved. They are of the genuine breed, said the man whom I had known abroad, and being out for exercise have no doubt escaped from their keeper. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.